position. Okay, great. So we'll just we could just jump in. Okay, so we did the last time we finished Siman Aleph, which talked about the prerogative, the obligation rather, to appoint Batei Din in the Jewish people, and to make sure that there's easy access to these things. And we talked about some of the basis for the institution of Beit Din. Now we're gonna in Siman Bet, Al the Shulchan Aruch, the Torah and the Beit Yosef, they jump into a very interesting topic. That it's interesting how they place this in Siman Bet already in section two of the Shulchan Aruch. It seems that they want to like get this out of the way, like they want to address the elephant in the room, which is essentially, the powers of Beit Din and the institution as a whole. Beit Din is extremely, extremely conservative, and I mean conservative with a small c, meaning Beit Din is very, very limited. Intentionally, in terms of what actions they're going to take. The standard of evidence is extremely, extremely high. How much a person can sue for damages in Beit Din is already, it's right, the categories are very, very rigid. As we will see later on, there's no such thing as I think that I was hurt, to the tune of $1 million, so therefore I'm gonna sue for $1 million. That's not how it works. There's predetermined measurements in terms of figuring out how much a person can sue for and how much he can't sue for. And again, the standard of the proof that's required from Beit Din, even in order to execute judgments, even on the things that they can execute judgments on, is already very high. So a person might say, okay, if this is the tool of justice that society has, like, aren't there going to be people that are going to A, take advantage of this in order to execute crime, in order to do crimes and get away with it? And even if they're not intentionally like finding the loopholes in the law, just it seems to be a very, very rigid form of justice. Like, how can a society function if the tool to execute justice is so rigid? So to this question, the Chazal actually formulated many answers to this problem, and the main source of this is the Gemara in Baba Kama in Daf Tzadi Vav. And the way that the Gemara phrases this over here is Beit Din Makin Va'onshin Shelo Min Hadin. It is possible for the courts to mete out punishments that are not delineated by the law. Shelo Min Hadin. Now, the Gemara gives many several examples of this, right? It says that there was a guy who was keeping right, Tahu Gavra, right? The Shorei Olas Tinuka, that there was a horrible, horrible situation where this person was keeping in his flock of animals an ox that was extremely violent. And then one day this ox went out and like bit off the arm of a small child. So they, according to the strict letter of the law, okay, fine. So it's personal injury. You have to pay a certain amount of money. You have to pay for the damages to the child. You have to pay for the pain that you inflicted, et cetera, et cetera. But because it was known that this person was acting in a negligent way, keeping this animal to begin with, so they inflicted very, very, very harsh, 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 harsh judgments on this person, and they inflicted a very, very high fine, right? Because the circumstances warranted it. Now, before we go any further, I wanted to see some of the sources in the Rishonim on this.
But
I think
that
we
means,
mentioned this the
based on what
first
you're
time.
saying, is that there's no limit. The Beit Din does not have parameters per se for damages. They can apply whatever they see fit based on
They
the
could, we
place and
see that they,
context.
we see, right. So we see that Beit Din has the ability to apply extrajudicial punishments on people. This is true. We're going to get to the source to see what the parameters of applying this power are, because there are parameters to it. But just before we jump into the technicalities of that, I just wanted to recall, I believe that we mentioned this in our first conversation, that there's a very important source in the Ran, in the Drashos HaRan, where he is talking about the more of like the philosophy behind the actions of Beit Din. And he emphasizes that really there are supposed to be two parallel forms of justice in the Jewish people going on simultaneously. There's supposed to be the justice of the court system, right, which is which is a formal system. A person comes in, he brings lawsuits, he brings claims against the person. That's one system of justice. And then there's supposed to be the king. The king, which is what we would call today perhaps the executive, where they address problems in the society as they come up. Meaning it's not predetermined according to the rules, according to the monetary rules of the Torah, but rather it's meant to be a case-by-case basis where they see problems coming up and they address them as they come up. So these are supposed to be two parallel forms of judgment. However, says the Ran, the entire time the Jewish people have been in exile, that additional system of judgment doesn't exist because the Jewish people are in exile. They don't have an executive. They don't have their own government that they're able to, execute this type of power. So over time, these two powers have been fused together. They've been fused together in one body, i.e., the Beit Din. So there's been kind of like this back. There's kind of been this right this conflation between the Beit Din power and the power of the king, and they're often held by the same body, as we'll see in a moment from the Tshuvas HaRosh, that actually there were certain institutions in the Jewish people that kind of functioned as a quasi executive. It typically wasn't one person; it was usually a council. The Gemara refers to this as the Tuvei Ha'ir, the good council of the city, and they essentially functioned as a king. They essentially functioned as the chief executive of the king of the city, and they had the powers to institute these types of things.
Even
So,
though a king, I thought, was extra judiciary. That was the purpose of a king, to go beyond the court system.
correct, correct. That is the point. That's exactly what we're saying. That's
So is
exactly
that
what we're saying
strange? We have
now.
a
But
court
right.
system. You're defining the court system as being defined as extra court system.
Yes. Yes, it is. That's exactly what it is.
I mean, that seems like an oxymoron, but okay.
I'm gonna make one more last ditch attempt to see if I can
Also, just to
get
ask you, today I was told that many courts they don't look for a psak, they look for pshera.
Pshara, exactly, 100%.
Now,
We're gonna
now
get to
what?
that. There's a whole siman. Maybe we'll do the next time we'll skip ahead to that because it's actually a very, very relevant section. That the ideal is that Beit Din comes to a compromise, as opposed to giving the strict letter of the law. It's actually a very important idea. I think next time we can have a thing about that because it is actually very important. Hold on, just one second for me. I'm going to make one last ditch attempt to fix my computer over here, and if it doesn't work, then so be it. Okay. So it doesn't look like it's going to work. Anyway, you guys can hear me. You guys can see me. It's basically okay for the time being.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay. So moving forward. So I want to read you from, I'm going to read a section. First, I want to quote over here from the Tshuvas HaRashba in the, right, in the Chelek Gimel of Tshuvas HaRashba. So he says as follows, Ro'a ani she'im ha'edim ne'emanim etzel ha'brurim. That if you have a situation where we have reliable witnesses that are believed by the court, Rishayim Haim, they, i.e. the Dayanim, the judges, are allowed, liknos mamon or la'onosh onesh haguf. They're able to inflict a financial punishment or even corporal punishment, kafi asher yira lahem, as they see fit. Vezeh mikiyum ha'olam, and this is necessary for the sustaining of the world. She'im atem ma'amidim hakol al hadinim haksuvim b'Torah, that if the courts, they place all their standards on just the laws that are written in the Torah, v'shelo and to only mete out the penalties that are listed explicitly in the Torah, nimsa ha'olam charev, the world will be destroyed. Meaning, it's not going to be enough in order to maintain law and order. Essentially, that's what the Rashba is saying. Shehayinu tzrichim eidim ma'asra, because as we know, the Torah requires for all witnesses. It requires the witnesses to approach the person and warn them that what they're doing is a crime. And not only that, but the criminal needs to respond and say, yes, I recognize that it's a crime and I'm doing it anyway. As we know from the Gemara and Makot, people are probably familiar with this. This, among other things, was the basis of Rabbi Akiva and many of his colleagues to say that basically, when it comes to the death penalty, we intentionally look for any possible loophole in order to get the guy off. Right? That was their approach to this, based on all these technicalities, because the Torah intentionally made these rules so tedious that it was basically impossible to inflict the death penalty. And if the courts wanted to, they could basically find a way to get the guy off. And
I
that was
thought in the
like
days
their
of
judicial
Rome,
philosophy.
I thought they didn't even have the power of death penalty. So I'm not, is this like a theoretical discussion?
No, so getting into the death penalty explicitly, it requires that the high court, the Sanhedrin, is a sitting body in order for the death penalty to be able to be applied anywhere. In order for the death penalty to be applicable, there needs to be a Sanhedrin in the world. According to many, there needs to be a Sanhedrin sitting on Harabayas. So if that central judicial body doesn't exist, there can't be the application of a death penalty anywhere. But as we know, the death penalty isn't really applicable anyway these days. So that's why we're not discussing it too much. But in theory, as we will see, even a local Beit Din are able to make extrajudicial laws that are appropriate to the specific circumstances that we find themselves in. That'll be the second source that we get. I just want to get through this Rashba quickly. So, and he quotes a very interesting Gemara, the Gemara from Baba Metzion on Daf Lamed. It says, "Lo charva Yerushalayim el sheheminu dinam al din Torah," that Jerusalem was destroyed because they sufficed their judgments on what the Torah said, meaning they saw what the Torah says, they saw what the halacha was, and they said, "Okay, we're doing the halacha, and that's it." Right? This is a very, very interesting source. This is basically saying that it's not enough to do just the letter of the law. You have to go beyond the letter of the law. Now, this, as you're probably thinking right now, like these sources and approaching them in this way can kind of like give license to anything. It can give a lot of free for all to people to be able to act in whatever they want, even the courts, right? The courts, in the end of the day, they're institutions that are run by human beings. And they feel that they have the license to like go above and beyond whatever they want anytime they want to, right? Things can very, very quickly get out of hand. There's an alternative explanation to this Gemara in Baba Metzia, which is actually it's connected to this topic that you mentioned before, Bruce, about the pshara, the compromise thing, which we'll get to, please God, next time. But the idea is basically this is not an admonishment of the courts when it says that Jerusalem was destroyed because they only practiced according to the Torah and they didn't go beyond the letter of the law. That's not rebuking the courts. It's rebuking the society as a whole. Meaning, it's saying it's the job of the court to interpret the law and apply the law as it's written. That's the job of the court. But the society as a whole can't suffice just by that. Meaning, like, right, it's like the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells the story of David HaMelech, that when a poor person would come before him in the court, who was being sued by a rich guy, and he saw that the poor person was actually liable. He said, "Listen, I'm sorry, right? I'm sorry, buddy, but you're actually, obligated to pay this guy." So he made the psak din that in fact the poor person was liable, and he forced the poor person to pay. And then afterwards, when they all walked out of Beit Din, so David HaMelech would pay himself. He would pay this poor person the amount that he was required to pay, because he understood that on the one hand I have to apply the letter of the law, but on the other hand there's a guy who's in distress. There's a guy who's in financial distress. It's not the job of the court to consider necessarily the personal circumstances of the people in front of them. Their job is to apply the law. So when it says Lo charva Yerushalayim el sheheminu dinam al din Torah, it's not admonishing the courts that they're doing the wrong thing. The courts are doing what they're supposed to do. It's admonishing the society that the society isn't coming in and filling that gap when it needs to be filled. She'ein done in dine knasos, says the Rashba, and it gets even worse nowadays when we're all in exile and we don't have the governmental tools to be able to apply these. All these problems, as you can see, they're all functions of the exile. They're all functions of the fact that all the systems of government that the Torah kind of outlines, they're not able to be applied well or at all. So that's the Rashba. In terms of the question about how such extrajudicial rules can be formulated and applied. So we mentioned before this idea, right, of the Tuvei Ha'ir, right, of the council of the city. The Gemara in Megillah discusses this a lot, discusses this idea of the council of the city, specifically in what context? If anyone knows, if anyone has any familiarity with the Gemara in Megillah, the Gemara discusses the idea of selling property that's been consecrated for the purposes of a mitzvah. So like a Beit Knesset, once a piece of property has been consecrated, so to speak, to be used as a Beit Knesset. So that's it. You can't change it into anything else. Like it, like that's the use. You can't go and, you know, take the Beit Knesset and, you know, transfer it to a casino. But you can't do that. So says the Gemara, if there's a need to sell the existing Beit Knesset, okay, so how would you do that? So it says the only way that you can do it is if the council of the city decides that they want to replace this Beit Knesset with another Beit Knesset. That's basically how they can do it. So if a private individual, he declares his house is going to be a Beit Knesset and people are using it and they're praying there 3 times a day, that private individual can't go back and say, you know, I decided I don't want this to be used as a Beit Knesset. I kind of want it to be used for my Monday night poker game. So he can't do that. He can't do that. However,
How did all these synagogues in the neighborhoods in America, which are no longer Jewish, they ended up as churches and
so
mosques
that
and
it's very it's this is very this is a very this is a very very problematic issue. It's a hugely problematic issue. And again, I don't want to oversimplify these halachos of selling the shul, because there are various ways that from the outset the consecration, so to speak, can be made on conditions. There are various ways to get around this, but on the whole, yes, it's a very problematic idea. Like we both have had stints in Baltimore. You know, if you go downtown where the Jewish community used to be, the Jewish community in Baltimore has moved like northwest over the decades. But it used to be that the Jewish community was downtown by the water, like much more resembling of a New York situation. So all these huge synagogues that are just, you know, lining the streets of old Baltimore, these huge, beautiful structures, they're all churches now. And it's not, it's, I think it's fair to say that a good chunk of them, if not most of them, this I have to confirm, but a good chunk of them were not strictly Orthodox church, Orthodox synagogues to begin with. So it's very likely that the people that were in charge of selling these buildings weren't necessarily interested in terms of what the halacha was, to put it lightly. So this next source over here from the Shulchan Aruch, from Klal Vav, and he's addressing this question from this city council that they're asking them about. He said, listen, we have certain issues going on in the community, and there's no clear halachic precedent to address these problems. So, like, how do we go about this? So says the Rosh the following: Rishayin b'nei ha'ir lahasiya al ktsasan lafi tzorech hasha'a lamigdar milsa. It's possible for the people of the city to activate certain penalties or certain prohibitions in order to address problems that are coming up, that are arising. V'im hu ani ve'ein yochel lo'ansha b'mamon. And says the Rosh, it's very similar to what we saw in the Rashba a moment ago, that if the violator of this ordinance, of this administrative ordinance that they decide on, if he's poor and unable to pay the monetary fine, rishayin la'ancho kanoso b'malkus, they're even able to apply corporal punishment to this person. Ad shi etzayis ladina, until he agrees to refrain from the violation. Velasus kishar kihilos kedusha perek elu megalchin, and he quotes from the Gemara in Moed Katan, that it says Menalan denaitzian, right? It's talking about a case in which it's basically like this, that you have these violators against an administrative ordinance that was invented or declared by the townspeople. Alma Rishain based in b'chol ir ve'ir lirdos uliaser b'chol mina reduin v'niduin, that they are able to make any punishment for any penalty, for any administrative prohibition that they want, hamasarivaltakana, and they're able to punish those who violate these rules, essentially. So we see that there is this tremendous, tremendous power over here, of extra judicial power, that the Torah intended this role to be filled by the king and his, you know, executive administrations. And because there's no king in the Jewish people, and the right and Jewish communities are living scattered around throughout the entire right their entire uh throughout the entire diaspora. So they have to fill the gap in whatever way they possibly can. Now, what the Rush is saying over here, which kind of like, it kind of reins in this power a little bit. He's saying that this can't be done in like a willy-nilly type of way. It has to be that that the council of the city, they come together and they make a formal decision that they're going to prohibit such and such an action. It seems to be that's the way to go about this. It can't be that in the moment they come together and decide we're going to apply this punishment. Although there are some sources that apply that as well, that the court can just kind of decide. We're going to see the Rambam in a minute. But what the Rush is alluding to, he says, listen, the proper way to go about this, the proper way to wield this extrajudicial power is that there's a city council and they make a formal decision. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to prohibit. And the people who violate this, the penalty is X, Y, and Z. That's the idea. Now, why? Now, a person might ask, okay, well, why is this in Hilchot Dayanim? Why is this in Choshen Mishpat, which deals with courts? This is by definition not in the courts. This is something that's beyond the court. So the whole idea is that once this becomes the law of the locale, once the council of the city decides that this is the law, the Beit Din, which again is technically limited to Torah law, but now the Beit Din can now make judgments based on the laws that were enacted by the city council. So it's not just the Torah laws that they're deliberating on, but it's also the city council laws that are now within the purview of Beit Din to apply based on the technicalities before them. This is a very important idea. It's not just the Torah laws that they're analyzing, but it's also all the takanot, all the enactments that are made that are applicable in that situation.
You're talking about a secular council, just a moetzah.
Correct. Correct. It's a completely secular council. Completely secular.
Well,
A
isn't the
real
Beit Din always subservient, so to speak? If it doesn't count, go against the Torah, isn't there some sort of unofficial, official agreement that Beit Din will follow the laws of the land? I'm not sure about if that's in Israel,
So the
but
right,
out
so
of
the
Israel.
right, so the question, the subject of Dina de Malchut Adina is a very complex one. There's different forms of Dina de Malchut Adina. The most applicable and therefore the most important area of Dina de Malchut Adina is talking about what is considered expected of the two parties when they enter a certain type of deal. So, like for example, and this is actually very, very important to know because it's very, very much applicable. That if, for example, it is the law of the land that when you enter a contractual agreement, so there's certain types of liens that go onto the person's property that back up his commitment. So, like he committed in a contract to, pay a certain amount of money or enter a certain business deal, and then he doesn't follow through with his commitments. So, how much of his property is under lien that can be confiscated in order to pay what he obligated himself to pay? That's an open question. That's not like a clear question. There's different types of shi'abudim. Shi'abud means a lien that I am mishabed, like an eved. I take my property and it's now subservient to my commitment. So there's different types of shi'abudim in the Torah. Different types. So if it's the law of the land, if it's the law of the land that there's a certain type of default lien that comes onto the person's property. So that's the law of the land. And even if two observant Jews, they enter a contractual agreement, so that's applicable to their deal. Yeah. So that's the most central and essential type of Dina de Malchuta. These technicalities of what are the parameters of certain types of business deals. And that actually is very applicable and it's important to know. The idea that you said before that Dina de Malchuta can, God forbid, contradict Torah law. So obviously that's something different. Right? That's something different. If there's a decree to explicitly violate the laws of the Torah, obviously that's not called Dina de Malchuta. That's called Shmad. Right? That's called persecution. Right? But the more important one is the one that I described. That there are laws that define the parameter of business deals, and those are very, very much applicable. Just want to read the last source over here. Dealing with this because this is really the end.
Oh, but somehow in Eretz Israel, that rule may not apply for whatever reason. There's a little
So,
controversy over that.
Right. So there are Rishonim that imply that in the land of Israel, so because the land can't be owned, so to speak, by an individual person, the land is owned by God. So therefore, it's not possible to make any rules because you don't own the land. Now, this is based on the understanding that the whole idea of Dina d'Malchuta is because the Melech, the king, owns the country, like it's his property. The country belongs to the king. And it's like a very, very, it's like you can sense it's a very like medieval type of idea that they understood that the king, he's the boss. He literally owns everything. And since he owns everything, he can make decisions on it, just like you can make decisions on your own property. He can make decisions on the country. And on that basis, they're saying, oh, well, if that's the basis of it, then that means that, right, in Eretz Yisrael, that's not the case because no one owns the land of Israel, right? It's owned by God, right? Famously, the Pasuk in Vayikra, right? In the laws of Shemitah says, Kili kol ha'aretz, right? I own, right? Excuse me, that's the Pasuk in Shemos, right? Kili kol ha'aretz, I own the land. Geirim etoshavim atem imadi. That was the Pasuk I was thinking of, right? God says, listen, you're like sojourners with me. You're here in the land at my liking. You're here because I allow you to be here. And you're not here because you own it. So that's based on this type of very, black and white understanding of Dina de Malchuta, that since the king owns the country, so therefore he can do whatever he wants. And since Eretz Yisrael isn't owned by the king, so therefore he can't do it. He can't apply those types of rules. However, the more, what I think is the more, perhaps rational, or legalistic type of view of Dina de Malchuta is that, again, is, you know, there's executive power that is given to certain governmental bodies to make decisions to address the specific problems that are in the society. And because of this collective agreement that gives power to the government bodies, so they're able to enact what they need to enact. And it applies in the land of Israel, outside the land of Israel. It's not, right, there's no distinction to that, right? On the contrary, in the land of Israel, there's even more of a need, right, that the Torah emphasizes to make sure that there's mishpat, as right as the pasuk in Mishlei says, Melech b'mishpat yamid eretz, that the king is meant to sustain the land through his proper judgment, like that's what the king is supposed to do, and if he's not doing that, he's not doing his job. So just the last source over here from the Rambam. This is at the very very end of Hilchos Sanhedrin in Perek Chafdalet. So he says, Yesh lebeit din lahalkos mi she'enu mechuyav malchus v'harog mi she'enu mechuyav nisan. Like right off the bat, this goes very, very strong. It says Beit Din is allowed to mete out corporal punishment and even to execute people that aren't actually chayav nisa according to the Torah. V'lo la'avor al divrei Torah, not with the intention of violating the words of the Torah, ela la'asa siag la'Torah, in order to make a fence, in order to make like safeguards to the law of the Torah. V'cheven sharon beis din. When the Beit Din identifies that there's right, that the people are acting in some outrageous way, they're able to add on prohibitions and to mete out punishments according to what they see fit. Now that's very, very interesting. What the Rambam is saying is that this is the exact opposite approach in a way to what the Rush said. Whereas the Rush was implying that the ideal way of doing this is that there should be a council in a city, and the council, like, they take a vote or something and they formally make a decision, like, we're adding on this prohibition, right? We're adding on this prohibition to the prohibitions that are forbidden here. The Rambam says, on the contrary, no, it has to be a case-by-case basis. It can't be anything permanent, because once you make it permanent, that's violating the idea of the Torah, because the Torah wants these laws to be applied and not other laws, right? On a case-by-case basis, it's something that's applied, in a unique scenario, so that's okay. But it can only be a horos shah. It can only be temporary. The Gemara tells the story of a person that they punished because he was intimate with his wife in public in the middle of the street. Right, the time of the Greeks. This is actually an interesting case worth discussing. It's actually an example that's brought over there in the Gemara in Baba Kama, that in the time of the Greek occupation, leading up to the Maccabean revolt, so there were there were Jews, as we know, that became outright Hellenists and essentially collaborators with the Assyrian Greek occupiers. So it became very fashionable to publicly violate certain laws of the Torah. And one of the things that became, like a regular expression of Greekness was that people would ride down the street on their horses on Shabbat. That was like a thing, right? If people are familiar with the story of Elisha ben Avuya, right? The Tanaic sage who went off and became a, right? He completely abandoned the Torah and he became a Roman collaborator. So the story is that he was, right? He rode down the street on his horse on Yom Kippur, and his former pupil, Rabbi Meir, was, trying to follow him and, trying to talk him out of it, so to speak. So it says that there was an individual who, right, who was like this Hellenized Jew who decided that he was going to go ride down the street with right on his horse on Shabbat, and they took him b'saklu and they stoned him. They stoned this guy. The Gemara also tells the story of Shimon ben Shetach, who was who was the brother of Shlom Tzion, correct? Bruce, he was the brother of Shlom Tzion.
Yeah.
Shlom Tzion was the last queen of the Maccabean dynasty. I mean, her two sons, who were clearly a bit narcissistic, they like brought the end because they created a
Oh,
civil war
that's
between
civil
them,
war, yeah.
right? And
Well,
they brought the Romans in, and that was basically
the
it. So
brother flees, and then she brings him back. I mean, then he stacks the court. I love the way that works.
right. And in the end of the day, they have like an outright civil war, and they both invite the Romans to be mitigators, right? Like they both kind of like reach out to Rome to try to be, like to work out the situation, and that's like basically the beginning of the end. That's the end of the Hasmonean dynasty. So Shlom Tzion, who there's a street named after her, great restaurants over there. There's a street named after her, and she's the last, really the last queen of the Hasmonean dynasty. And her brother Shimon ben Shetach happens to be the head of the Sanhedrin. He's the Nasi. He's the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. So Shimon ben Shetach takes the opportunity while his sister is in charge to enact various corrective measures to the Jewish people in terms of halachic observance. The most famous one, by the way, is the whole institution of a ketubah. The whole institution of a ketubah was instituted by Shimon ben Shetach and Shlomtzion Hamalka during this period of time. We're talking like late Hasmonean period. So all of Maseches Ksubos, so all right, that whole tractate of Talmud is basically formulated at this time. And one particular incident that's listed over here that has to do with our conversation is that he went and rounded up 80 witches, right, in one day and had them all executed in one day. Which seems ra right, which is right, which is very intense. But right, in order to deal with this cult of witchcraft that was spreading throughout the Jewish people, it has actually took place in Ashkelon of all places. I'm not sure why Ashkelon was so popular for witchcraft, but that was the incident that
It
took
was a
place in
free
this day.
city. People could do what they wanted to.
Yeah, that's why it was a free
Yeah,
city.
it wasn't under jurisdiction. You had to send in some yeshiva guys to trick the women
Right,
to pick them
right,
up
right.
off the
That's right.
ground and schlep them up to Jerusalem. The whole story.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure we want to take these stories quite literally, but
I hope, yes. Right. I mean, I don't think that the number 80 is a specific, but it means more than one, basically. It means more, meaning it's not like one individual. It's like a group of these
But
ones.
later, as a result of that story, his son gets set up and put to death. Remember his son, and doesn't rely upon his father to help get him off legitimately, but he didn't want to use any protection. So they put his
Right.
son to death. It's kind of a bad story. It goes again, normally you have these stories of courts never put to death, and then you have these contradicting stories. So it's.
Yes, correct. I mean, the context over there is to kind of say that once you step out of bounds, even if you're stepping out of bounds for the right reasons, so to speak, so it can come back to bite you. This is
Oh.
the theme over here. And this is how the Rambam ends off this section in the 24th chapter of Hilchos Sanhedrin. It says, it's very, very important that a person should conduct all of his actions for the sake of heaven. And the honor of creatures, meaning the honor of man, should not be a small matter in his eyes. And all the more so the children of the forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, hamachzikim b'toras emes, that were given the Torah of truth, shiyeh zayir shelo yaharis kvodam, that you should not trample upon their honor. Ela lehosif b'chavod hamakom, rather a person should always seek to increase their honor and the honor of God, bilvad, only the honor of God. Shekol ha-mevaza es ha-Torah gufo mechulal, because anyone who desecrates the honor of the Torah, his own body will become desecrated. Alabrios. V'hamachabit es ha-Torah, and those who give honor to the Torah, gufo mechubad alabrios, the ein kovod ha-Torah, and the primary way of expressing the honor of Torah, la'asos al pi chukei ha-mishpatea, is in order to conduct oneself according to the laws and the statutes of the Torah. Meaning, not to add these extra laws and these extra rules onto how the Beit Din or anyone else functions. In order to go according to the chukim and the mishpatim, the orders and the statutes of the Torah, and not to add on to anything else. Once you're adding on additional things, that is, in a way, it's degrading the Torah. It's like the basis for probably the most famous instance of violating the Torah for the right reasons is the very authorship of the Mishnah itself. Yeah, so Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi famously makes the decision to write down the Mishnah, right, to codify the oral Torah, and right, this is based on the verse in Tehillim Kuf Yutes, right? Eis la'asos la'Hashem, when there's a time to act for the sake of God, heferu Torah secha, the Torah is undone. So there is this aspect of the Torah being undone, meaning we are compromising on our principles over here. So it's kind of like a catch-22, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because on the one hand, you see that there's an immediate need to act beyond the parameters of the right of the strict letter of the law. On the other hand, by doing that, you are undermining the essential nature of the letter of the law. So there's this real tension over here, and there's no clear answer that they're left off with. The Rambam, right, he ends off with, listen, if you do this, you're going to be violating the honor of the Torah. Like that's basically what you're doing. You're violating the honor of the Torah. You're compromising on your principles, and that, right? You're just opening the Pandora's box. Can you do it? Yeah, you can do it. You want to pay the price for that? You can decide. You can decide if you want to pay the price for that. And you know, just on this, I'll just allow myself to go on like a small 1 minute tangent before we shift to the next topic. The Rambam discussing this very example in history of the decision to write down the oral Torah. So the Rambam in Nor Nevuchim, he discusses this idea. He says, why is it that it was that the Torah prohibits writing down the oral Torah? The Gemara in Gittin discusses this. It says it's a very, very stringent prohibition that, you know, basically you can write your private notes from the shiur that you heard, but beyond that, you can't write down anything. You cannot write down the oral Torah. So why is this such a stringent prohibition? So says the Rambam, very, 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 very interesting approach. He says, because the only way that you can really understand any complex, sophisticated subject is learning it directly from a master. That's the only way that you can hope to have an understanding of the thing. You can't really understand anything sophisticated by reading it in a book. You can't. It's not possible. So once the Torah Shebaal Peh starts being written down in books and people feel that they can get a complete understanding of the oral Torah just by reading books, that is the beginning of the end for proper understanding of Torah. Meaning people need to have the idea in their heads that in order for me to be able to learn the Torah, I need to go to a master and hear it directly from the master and learn directly from him. But once the Torah starts being written down, so people are relying on books in order to be able to orient themselves, and that's just the beginning of the end. So therefore you cannot write down books. And he says, and this is the Rambam over 800 years ago writing this. So he says, and you see today how lowly the scholarship has become, because everyone is learning their Torah knowledge from books and not seeking out masters that can instruct them. That's what he says in the Mar. Right? So all the more so today, how, you know, there's just books are all over the place, and you know, books are great. Obviously, the fact that we have easy access to information is a tremendous blessing. But with that, but that blessing is a double-edged sword. That while we have tremendous access to information, it also it also undermines our need to communicate directly from people that have the tradition from the previous generation that can give it to us in a right in a face-to-face fashion, which is the most right in the end of the day, it's the most powerful and authentic way to do that. So similarly, over here, does the Torah give the authority to the executive powers either in Eretz Yisrael or outside of Eretz Yisrael? Does it give the does it give those bodies the ability to create new laws and to even mete out punishment? Yes, the Torah gives the a power for these organizations to do that. Is that ideal? Absolutely not. It's totally not ideal. It's like not ideal even a little bit. And I think that it's fair also, just it's now coming up in my head right now, I think it's very fair to make a sharp distinction, because I started off saying that it seems that the Rambam and the Rush are kind of arguing over here about like the ideal situation. The Rush is describing, well, if you have a city council, they can make a formal decision and they could, you know, have that the rule of the land forever. And the Rambam is saying, no, you can't have it the rule of the land forever. You can only do it by a case-by-case basis, but you can't establish new laws all the time. So I think now it's actually more logical to say, and this is actually Meduyak from the right, from the words of the Rush, he's talking about administrative laws. We're talking about things like, you know, where to put the traffic lights, or you know, where the trash cans should go. Things like that. Things that they're just a necessary part of life. Like you have to make decisions on this, and the Torah doesn't
Well,
give
that
laws.
has nothing to do with the Beit Din.
Doesn't
Why
have what?
does that have why is that a Beit Din question?
Well, so as we said, it's going to it can easily become a Beit Din question, because let's say for example, the example that I just gave a second ago, people decide, you know, the trash collection is going to be done on, you know, on these and these days, and you know, don't put your trash out in the middle of the street unless it's the day where the trash is being collected. So let's say a person puts his trash in the middle of the street, you know, 3 days before the trash is collected, and it's just sitting there, and it's disrupting people, and people can't travel, people can't move, people, you know, it's disrupting business. That now becomes a Beit Din issue, right? People can be sued on the basis of that. So the person can come to Beit Din and say, well, it's not a law in the Torah that I can't put my trash over here. It doesn't say that anywhere in the Torah, but Beit Din will respond, yeah, but it is a rule in this city. It's a rule in this municipality that you can't do that.
Doesn't
And
the
Beit Din, right?
Mawatza
Beit
act super Beit Din capacity? They just give you a fine. I mean, there's no Beit Din. There's no recourse. They get like
well,
a it's like a parking
it's not
ticket.
a
I mean,
It's not a it's not a question it's not a question of recourse or appeal. That's not the question. The question is when there needs to be when there needs to be a court-based analysis about that law, what's the court that handles it? That's the question, right? Like let's say there's a question. Did he violate the ordinance or not? Like, is this technically in violation of this law or is it not? Like, who makes that decision?
I didn't even
So
know that
okay, so
one
you're
could
right.
take
In our current environment, the person that may, right the body that makes that decision is the Moitzah, right? The Moitzah just makes the decision. They decide did you violate it or not. If they decide that you did, then they send you a ticket,
Can a
right? But
citizen take
ideally,
the Mawatza to a Beit Din? I mean,
can they take them to a bait? I don't know if it'll help them. I don't
No,
know if they'll
if
respond.
a citizen thought a ticket was unfairly given, he wants to
Yeah.
contest that ticket. I think in it, I'm only for I'm Israel. There's like the regular courts.
In
I'm
an
not sure
idea,
what falls under the
right.
purview of Beit Din here, but.
So in an ideal situation, and maybe this is probably an actual important takeaway over here. In an ideal situation, the council, the local council, like the Moetzah or the Tu Ve'ha'ir or whatever label you want to give to it, the local council will make laws to administrate the that local area. And when there are questions of violations, meaning if it's not clear whether the person actually violated it, or the person wants to challenge the violation, Beit Din would be the one to adjudicate that decision. Like that's the ideal situation. That would be the ideal situation. Does that is that what happens today in the modern state of Israel? Clearly not.
If are they obligated to go to a Beit Din? If you do want to take someone to Beit Din, in any case, by the way, don't both
Yeah.
parties have to agree to go to the Beit Din?
Of course. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And I think we talked about this before, that in a case where, you know, a person files a lawsuit against someone in Beit Din, and the would-be defendant is totally not cooperative, so in such a case, a person can go to secular courts. That is in fact That is in fact what happens often. It's a sad situation when that happens, but very often people are sued in Beit Din. They refuse to cooperate. And in that case,
No, but I think in Israel they have family law rights. They can't all,
jurisdiction, exactly.
yeah,
So that is
jurisdiction
an
rights.
example. So you see that even in modern Israel, there is a circumstance in which there are these, extra judicial, I wouldn't say extra judicial. There are these laws that are clearly not delineated in the Torah. The specificities of like child support and all these things are not delineated in the Torah. They're laws that were formulated either by some by Beit Din itself, some by the secular system, and the courts that adjudicate that is Beit Din. Now, whether or not that's the ideal situation is not the point. The point is that you see that this is an example of something like that happening, that there are these extra, beyond the Torah rules that are formulated, and Beit Din is the one that makes the decision how to apply them.
So that's the case. I have no idea. Maybe other people know better. I thought in Israel, let's say people getting divorced, if one person runs to the secular court and files first in secular court, they actually have jurisdiction. But if one of the parties goes to the Beit Din and files first, the Beit Din is jurisdiction. And
No, I
women
have no
would
idea.
prefer
I
secular court.
understood that like the default for people that were married according to Israeli law, i.e. through the Rabbanut, that the Rabbanut had automatic jurisdiction over like
No,
the
I'm not sure
Jewish
about
issue.
that. They may have to
I don't
alter
know. I really don't
the
know. I
get a
don't know.
get
That
through
was
the
my
rabbinate,
understanding.
but
Could be that I'm wrong about that. Could be that I'm wrong about that. Okay. So that was Siman Bet.
also, if
So
you can comment on it, you know how there's different kinds of courts, federal, state, all these kinds of courts. I have no idea how the Beit Din system is. I mean, we get these emails, what's it called, Eretz Chamda. I know that there's certain Beit Din, but I'm not sure what Beit Din one would go to if it's set up like secular court, where you have to really be pick the appropriate court, or any Beit Din is fine to or not. Like the people have to agree, maybe it's in their area, but certain courts only handle one case; they're specialized, or do they handle everything? I have no idea how it works here.
Right. Hopefully you won't ever have to know how it works. But the short answer is that, anyone can set up a Beit Din. Once you're a qualified Dayan, you're allowed to set up a court. You could just go at it. We still technically do have a Beit Din running out of our Beit Midrash. And, people can reach out. This is very informal. That's like, if I had to choose like one single aspect of the Torah system of judgment, it would for sure be this, about like how smooth and simple it's designed to be. It's not designed to be this major, stress-inducing bureaucratic process of, you file now and you do a week of paperwork, and then a year later they have the first hearing, and then they decide, to do the next hearing a year after that. It's not this drawn-out process. It's meant to be very simple, very straightforward, and very quick. That's like for sure the best aspect of the Torah's system of judgment. So again, a
So
person
how
can
does
decide
anyone know
free
where
if you
there's a
have if you
qualified
have
Dayan? Like, what does that even mean?
so well it require you know it requires a tremendous amount of study and expertise.
No, for the
And
citizen to know, and not on behalf of the Dayan, on
no,
behalf of the
you're saying
person.
for oh so okay so I would say that that works in a very similar way. That people decide which kashrut certification they're going to choose. People have to do their due diligence to like know the expertise of the court, if the court is reliable. But again, in this world of Batei Din, there are names that are that maintain very 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 good reputation, so to speak, in terms of their expertise. And again, as you pointed out, like because there's no element of coercion at all, like in the end of the day, both parties have to agree to come. So the authority of the court, it doesn't come from their own authority in the end of the day. It comes from the willing participation of both parties. So organizations like Eretz Chemda, for example, Eretz Chemda is, in my opinion, by far just head and shoulders above in terms of their professionalism and the way that they function. They just they really have their act together. In addition to having like very, very serious scholars on board, it's
Is there a
based in
language
Katmandu.
barrier? I mean,
Sorry?
is there a language barrier for us Anglos, or would you say that
No,
that on that court?
they have English speaking Dianame. In fact, I know one of the English speaking Dianame who lives in remote. They have them. I think they have been multiple languages. I know they have some Russian speakers and Spanish speakers. They have a lot of people on board for them for that reason, because they want to be able to provide like a functioning system which is accessible and can like provide this need to the community, to like the Torah observant world. Like they want to be able to do that, and I think they do it very, very well. So yeah, so please God, we won't have to know anything about these things, but if we do, you know, these are the systems, how they're acted out. And yeah, anyway, I just wanted to give a few minutes on the Rosh Hashanah theme, because you know we're fast approaching the day over here, and there are really two points that I wanted to quote, and maybe try to string them together. There's this the practice of the simanim, that on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, some people do it on the second night of Rosh Hashanah as well, right? We eat these foods that we're essentially, it kind of seems like we're playing like word games with these foods. The apple and the honey, the leek, the gourd, the fish head, like all these things. I just wanted to just act ask them like a very blunt way, like when Chazal talk about this, like what are they trying to say? So this is a very, very straightforward question. Like, what is the message of this simanim business? And I think that many people know about the simanim, talk about the simanim, but very few people, as far as I've seen, just go to the original source of where the simanim are discussed and just see what the Gemara says about it. The source of the of this custom is a Gemara in Maseches Horios on Daf Yud Beis Amud Aleph, and the Gemara says as follows. It starts off by asking, you know, person is in a situation, Zuman Debay, Haiman Debay Leida Imasik Shate Olo. A person wants to know whether he will live for the following year or not. Nitle Shraga Ba'asra Yomim Debay Rosh Hashanah Yom HaKippurim. So he should take a candle and light it during one of the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim. Bebeisei Tilonoshev Zika, in a house where there's no wind. Imoshech Nehorei Neda Damasik Shate. And if the flame of the candle burns smoothly, then that's a good omen for the rest of the year. Okay. Now there's a question that's asked on this, the most obvious question of like, how is this not violating the prohibition of divination, of Nichush? Right,
Right.
Nichush is like a prohibition in the Torah. Like you can't do things in order to like see an indication for the future. And that's a very fair question. I actually don't know the answer to that question. It's very suspicious. But this is not the main point. This is a lead-in into the topic of Simanim and Rosh Hashanah. So the Gemara says it lists these various things that a person can do that are like indications of their health. Indications of right of their right, of their future success, etc., etc. So says the Gemara, right? A person should not do any of these things. A person shouldn't do these things. Why not? Kevan de isra mazle, because if the person sees the negative omen, okay, cholsha da'ate, it's going to affect him. It's going to affect his mind. Meaning, the bad sign that you see and the nervousness and the anxiety of like the coming bad thing that's going to happen in the future, that anxiety is going to be worse than anything that is actually going to come. That's what it says. Dilma cholsha date umisra mazle. Okay? That's what the Gemara says. Meaning you can do these things and they can give you, perhaps accurate indications of what's going to happen in the future, but you shouldn't do them, because if you do them, then it's just going to, cause you anxiety. It's going to cause you to be depressed, and that's going to be worse than anything that is going to actually happen. This is kind of like, this is a little bit connected to what Rabbi Fishman was talking about in his discussion of the shofar business. Anyway, so says the Gemara, okay, Amar Bai, Hashta da Amart. From this we see, from this, meaning this idea that a person should not do these divinations because the stress and anxiety and depression that's going to be brought upon him by doing this is going to be worse than anything that's actually going to happen. We see that a simna is a milta. A siman is an actual substantive thing. It's a milta. Okay? Liolam, therefore, yehi ragil lemechze bereshata, a person should bring on Rosh Hashanah, kra verubia karte vesilka, all these various vegetables, the leeks and the gourds and the beets, vitamre and dates, and have and he should have these foods before him on Rosh Hashanah. Okay? So what is the therefore? Meaning, like, what's the connection? Like, what is it saying? Is that because divination could give you these bad, right, this stress and this bad state of mind, therefore on Rosh Hashanah you should do all these simanim business? What's the connection between those two things? So we see, I think this is just very, very clear that the purpose of the simanim is in order for a person to get himself into a certain headspace. That's basically what the simanim are trying to do. What's the headspace? What's the headspace that the person is meant to be in? The person is meant to be in the headspace of that whenever he interacts with a certain thing, it gives it, right, it triggers within his mind a certain connotation. That's what the person is trying to do. When a person sees the selek, when a person sees beets, he says, "Ah, yisalku sonenu." When a person sees the gourd, the karte, he says, "Sheikartu sonenu." When a person sees the davash, the honey, says, "Ah, tehei shana mituka." It should be a sweet year. These should be the associations that a person should have in their mind. And on Rosh Hashanah, you make a formal practice session of this thing in order, right, of this practice in order to get it into your head, in order to formulate your mind, to formulate the way that your mind works, in order so it should have these associations. It's like I heard a very, very good story from Reb Dessler, that Reb Dessler was giving giving a class in Chanovich, and he quoted the Gemara in Menachot that talks about the tchelet, that talks about the blue string. And so the Gemara over there brings a braita from Rabbi Meir. It says that the Tehillat, it's like the ocean. It looks like the ocean. And the ocean looks like the sky. And the sky looks like the divine throne. So therefore, when you see the Tehillat, it should remind you of the divine throne. So one of the students asked Rav Dessler, he said, "What is this whole thing of the string looks like the ocean and the ocean looks like the sky? Like, what are all these like steps in between? Like, what's the significance of that? Like, you think I'm gonna like look at the tzitzit and like make all these, this string of associations in my mind?" So Rav Dessler said, "There's a halacha that a person shouldn't stare at the clothing of a woman that he knows, because if he stares at the clothing of the woman, it's gonna get him to think about the woman." He said, "Does that make sense to you?" He says, "Yeah, of course it makes sense. Like, I'm gonna look, like, if I know the woman and I'm staring at her clothes, so I'm gonna make the connection between the woman and the clothes." He says, "Okay, so it just, right, it just depends where your mind is at." It just depends what associations your mind naturally makes. Right? It's completely natural for a healthy man, when he sees just the clothes of a woman that he knows, to make the connection between the clothes and the woman. That's just a natural, right? It's like a primal association. But there are other associations that we can make. We can make associations with certain things that can trigger certain awarenesses in our minds if we want to. If we make that conscious effort to make those connections. So says the Gemara, a person can practice, so to speak, to make certain associations between the things that he confronts in the world and his relationship with the divine, the relationship with the divine domain. And this is the practice that we want to be in. Because just like a person can affect his state of being by exposing himself to negativity, a person can uplift himself and strengthen himself consciously and emotionally and psychologically by making associations with positive things. and this is what we want to do. And it could seem silly. It could, right on the surface, it could seem like, you know, this is like the antics of the Seder that are making their way into Rosh Hashanah. It's like, you know, we're doing things, you know, for the sake of the children, so to speak. But you know, when taken a little bit seriously, we can see that this is a practice that we're meant to consciously do in order to consciously formulate how it is that we think and our approach to the world. And you know, this is the day the Torah calls Yom HaZikaron, the day of memory. The day of memory in the sense that this is like the basis for everything else that emanates out of it. Like the memory is like the intellectual or ethereal basis for everything that follows afterwards. So what we want the pattern to start with this is how the pattern starts, so to speak. On Rosh Hashanah, the pattern starts now. The pattern starts now. And how the pattern starts will perpetuate the pattern into the future. And this is, I think, a very powerful idea to keep in mind on Rosh Hashanah, of like, you make the decision now of what you want the continuity to look like. And that's a very powerful tool to be able to kick it off in the direction that you want. So please God, we should merit to do that work on these days that are coming, and an opportunity to set into motion the patterns that we want for the coming year, and indeed for our lives in the big picture. Bezrat Hashem.
Thank you very much, Shammai.
Thank you very much.
Shammai, by the way, are the courts set up and maintained by the municipality? Are they sort of like private enterprises?
That's a very good question. So there used to be monetary courts that were funded by the state, like monetary batei din, that were funded by the state of Israel. And a few years back, that was ended. There are no state funded monetary courts. No state funded monetary batei din. Only family court is kept up by the state institutions.
So is it better that it's independent? Is that a step up in your opinion? Or?
It's a really good question. I don't have enough experience with with individual courts in order to give an answer to that. But I think that, I mean,
what?
I just think in general, it's good when things are, you know, disconnected from the state. The advantage of having something state funded is that it ends up being, you know, more available in the sense that, you know, the state funds it. So it, you know, pays the dayanim a stipend and they could be available to, you know, adjudicate cases when the need comes up. But again, there are private organizations that have found solutions to that. They don't need a governmental solution for that necessarily. You have these private organizations that have stepped up and have really done an excellent job in the logistics and in all the other aspects of this in order to provide solutions. So I don't think that's an inherently bad thing that they're private. In fact, I think that, you know, the more that they can be taken independently, the better. So,
and you haven't covered yet, I'm sure you will, the attention between going to the non-Beit Din versus the Beit Din, and when it's permitted, when it's not permitted, and is it better to be living in a frum community where in general everyone only goes to a Beit Din if such a thing exists? I mean, I don't know.
But even if you're living in an observant community, it's very difficult to avoid all interactions with people that will follow the authority of a Beit Din. It's just practically very, very difficult to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, if a person finds themselves, God forbid, where they need to, you know, file a monetary complaint against a Jew, so you know, they should at least attempt to come to an agreement with the person that they can adjudicate it in Beit Din. If there's absolutely no chance that can happen, then yeah, the person has the ability to go to secular court because they have no other. Have
also,
no
Beit Din is the formal term for it, but there's a Hebrew kolel that means stone says in the Geffen.
Okay.
And it's the Rosh Kolel's Rabbi Alfasi. And I know that the Sephardim there, they go to him for their, well, certainly their Jewish questions, but maybe they go to him for all questions. Like he is the Beit Din for them because they respect his opinion. And when they have a machloket, they ask him. Now, I'm not sure if that means that that's like a Beit Din, or maybe that is like a Beit Din when you're going to one person who's a mumper.
Right. So there is the question of, a Beit Din of the, right, a Beit Din of a panel where you have three judges, or a Beit Din of like one single expert who's like the lone Dayan who's going to make the decision. The short answer is that that is a very, very, it's a very undesirable case, right? The Mishnah in Avot says, Al tiyeh dan yechidi, a person should not make a judgment alone. She'ein dan yachid el yechido shel olam, right? The only one that can make an independent judgment, is the one, right? The one of the world, i.e. God. Meaning God makes judgments alone, but human beings should not make judgments alone. You should only make judgments, you know, within, with the counsel of other people and after receiving, right, the weigh-ins of other people, etc. So so for sure the ideal is that a Beit Din is always a panel, which by the way, doesn't have to be a panel of three. It could be a panel of however many people you want, as long as it's an odd number of people so that the court can't be deadlocked. But you can have a panel of five, a panel of seven, you can have a panel of however many people you want. However, if the idea is not to get a strict judgment, but rather to get some type of a right, some type of a pshara, some type of a compromise, then that's already different. If you're coming from the outset saying, listen, we don't want the strict letter of the law, we just want the Rav's help with working out a compromise. So that's much more acceptable and probably in many ways ideal, right? The two people could say, listen, we don't want to do the whole court thing. We just want the Rav's opinion on what the appropriate thing to do is, and that's what we'll do. So there, it's not a problem. You don't have to have like the whole, you know, panel of judges set up.
No,
So yeah,
because
that's
I
the
have tenants in my downstairs of the house, and I have leases. And the lease says if we have a machloket, we'll go to Rabbi Fassi. Everyone seems he's right across the street, very convenient. Everyone agrees. And
Right.
we've gone once or twice over the many years to various tenants. And he hears the case and he tells us what he concludes, and we just say, okay. Now, maybe people don't have to do that. Maybe people would, like, I don't know, continue arguing, or maybe they're not forced to follow. I mean, I don't know. It's all based on consent.
Yes, of course. This is like this is this these are the best ways of conflict resolution to do it like as simply and as quickly and with as little bureaucracy as possible. That's the best way to do it. When things escalate, that's when things get ugly. That's when things like, you know, you have to go to Beit Din and the people don't agree to go to Beit Din, so you have to take it to secular court. Gets right if you get right the all the different layers of escalation make it more and more complicated and more heavy for people.
Yeah, I
So
got out of a
the
dough.
most
Okay.
for sure the system that you just described to me, that's great. There's like a guy in the community, everyone respects him, everyone knows he's the address. When they have a machloket, when they need something resolved, they go to him and that's it. That's the ideal. That's the ideal way to do it. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Amai. And you have a
Awesome.
Shana
We'll
Tovah.
talk next week. Yeah.
And we'll see you next week in Mitzvah Shem. Hope all is
Shalom.
well.